from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
I ain't got no home nor nothing, I suppose. Misfortune seems to follow me wherever I goes. I come to California with a heart both stout and bold, and have been up to the diggings there to get some lumps of gold.
But I'm a used up man.
All right, in this hour, we want to look back, and really forward as well. The long tradition of economic booms and busts, you heard about it most recently from Governor Jerry Brown. They've shaped certainly Bay Area history, landscape, culture, and industry. And we want to discuss what lessons can be learned from the history as we grapple with the current economic and technological boom that is once again transforming our area. Let me tell you who is joining us for the hour here in studio. Richard White is professor of American history at Stanford University. He was with us last on Forum talking about his excellent book, Railroaded, the Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America. Good to have you back. Welcome.
Good to be back.
Christopher O'Sullivan, also with us this hour, teaches California history, University of San Francisco. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning to you. And we'll say good morning to Leslie Berlin, who's also here with us this morning, project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford University and author of The Man Behind the Microchip, Robert Noyce and the Invention of Silicon Valley.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to all of you, and thank you all again for joining us. And Richard White, I'm going to begin with you because I think you said that in the 1850s, around the time of the Gold Rush, this was the most bizarre place in the North American continent. But also, I was reading J.S. Holliday, who said this was maybe the Gold Rush, just to start with that, the most important event, not only in California history, but American history next to the Civil War. A grand statement.
A very grand statement. And I'd give him California. I don't think I'd give him American history. But in California, it makes California. I mean, it sets California off on a trajectory, which we're still going down the road. It started this on today. It makes California the capital of the West. It's San Francisco becomes a city very different from any other metropolis, any place in North America, and one of the only cities in west of the Mississippi that can compete with Boston, Washington, Philadelphia, New York.
Well, let's talk just for a moment about the distinct culture that grew up historically around that first boom, that is a gold rush. I mean, it was overly defined by wealth to a great degree, and it was also a place that had its own laws. I mean, it was pretty rough, as we learned from many of the writers of that time. There were lynchings. It wasn't the sort of culture that many of those who emigrated here from the Northeast particularly were used to.
No, it wasn't. It was an un-American place in a real sense, and it's un-American by that I mean in a society which largely organized itself around home, around family. This is a place without homes. It's a place without families.
And it was mostly men. What, 90%
men? 90% men. And it's not only men, and they're men from all over the world. I mean, a place where the United States had maybe 10% of the population were immigrants. It was near 40-50% in San Francisco. They had very little to hold them together except the search for wealth. And many California laws where it was a sort of libertarian paradise, as if nothing existed in human life except getting rich. And when you got rich, you didn't intend to stay here. You intended to go back. As I said at the time, it's, you know, California is a good place to make money, but New England's the place you want to spend it.
There are some analogies that creep into even present thought. Again, Richard White is professor of American history, Stanford, author of Railroaded, the Transcontinentals, and the Making of Modern America. Christopher O'Sullivan teaches California history at University of San Francisco. Let's talk a bit, Christopher O'Sullivan, about just booms in general. They usually mean new beginnings, as Kevin Starr said, but they're also often redolent of all kinds of hope, maybe illusion and pipe dreaming as well, but that's certainly what they're associated with and have been with every boom. But I want to get a sense from you of how we calibrate what the booms are. I mean, there was one with the gold rush. Then there was one again. There was kind of a silver boom and a small boom after that. The two world wars.
Yes. Well, consider some of the numbers to begin with. I mean, we have the gold rush, which almost stands alone in San Francisco, which was then the Mexican-Californian pueblo of Yerba Buena. The population was about 469 people at the time that gold was discovered. And they had just undergone a population boom because the population had been doubled to 469 by a huge boatload of Mormons who had just arrived in Yerba Buena just before that. Within a year, by 1849, the population of San Francisco was 25,000. So this was just an enormous explosion of growth, the likes of which I'm not sure if any other city, when we think of boomtown, San Francisco always comes to mind, even around the world. But other booms that have occurred in textiles with the Midlands and Britain and things like this, you never had this kind of overnight explosion.
And let me just jump ahead for a few, because after the railroad, that even, I'm thinking about the railroad in conjunction with Richard White's book, leaped even more.
Well, yes, but Richard can speak better to that than I, because he's written a very fine book about that. But he'll also point out that the anticipated boom that the Transcontinental was supposed to bring actually brought depression in the 1870s. But we had a silver boom at the end of the 1850s, which followed almost exactly 10 years on the gold rush. And there have been a series of booms in San Francisco involving real estate speculation. Consider this, that during the gold rush and throughout the 1850s, people think the property situation and the real estate situation in the city is acute right now, and indeed it is. But then people were buying water lots. And what that means is they were buying geographical areas in the bay with the anticipation that the bay would ultimately be filled into the point where they'd be able to build on that area.
A lot of tents, too.
That's right.
But let's jump ahead again, because we did see a boom after World War II, and that was largely a boom. And in fact, some argue that it went on until the 1990 recession because of government, defense, research,
That's
and
right.
all of that money.
The World War II boom sort of seamlessly went into the Cold War because there was a lot of spending pouring into California. Southern California benefited largely from aerospace. The San Francisco Bay Area, from all the bases that were here. We forget that the Bay Area historically is really a military area, and a lot of those bases closed after 1990. Consider this in terms of numbers. From 1950 to up at 1950 was about the peak population up till that time. About 825,000 people lived in San Francisco. There was a significant population decline from 1950 to about 1980. Where the population dropped to about 675,000. It's now bounced back up to about 825,000. So we're feeling the strain, the same kind of strain that began during the Second World War, where people were being housed in places that today would be considered lean-tos and not quality housing for anyone to live in.
Well, the one thing that binds all of these booms together is the recurrent sense of change and transformation, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
And leading right up to the present, which brings me to Leslie Berlin. But before I do that, I want to talk about just also the fact that World War II and that post-World War, Cold War boom, actually, as you described it, I think, correctly, really brought with it the building up of the two major universities. And now, by contrast, it's just kind of interesting to think of what the GI Bill did and all of that, contrasting now to all the debt that people are suffering
Absolutely.
With this boom, you know, college debt particularly.
Absolutely, Michael. Consider, I think one thing that really separates this boom from some of the previous ones is people are justifiably feeling the income inequality of this current boom. That wasn't really a major factor with some of the previous booms, particularly with the Second World War and with the Cold War boom, because a lot of the jobs that were being created by all that government largesse coming to the Bay Area were working class jobs, were jobs in shipbuilding and ancillary industries and things like that. So that's, I think, a real distinctive difference about the current boom from some of the previous ones is income inequality.
But let me just go back for a moment, Richard White, to you, because we saw, going back to the gold rush for a moment, extraordinary consumer market and overpricing, I mean, as a result of all the money that people had, particularly those who laid stakes to mines that they could mine and find gold at. I mean, there again are some parallels to the present. We've got high prices now, but we have consumer goods being produced not to such a great extent. I mean, Apple, yes, but a lot of ads being produced as a result of some of the new technology.
They're certainly high pricing, but what you had, and I think this is something that's missing from the current boom, is that there was a feeling that getting gold is a matter of luck, and it's open to anybody. And if you can get out here and you don't have a great deal of skill, you can strike it rich. And they realize that, in fact, there's not a lot of merit to striking it rich. Just nobody thinks of this as a meritocracy. If some people get rich, other people don't. And the wages just from at least in 49 and 50 from digging gold were enough that people could afford the prices. After that, they begin to move back. There's a great deal of disillusionment. But I think you have this sense of privilege, this talk about meritocracy, this sense of that wealth is something people deserve as a result of their hard work. I don't think that's Gold Rush language. I mean, they talk more the language of luck, of chance, of fortune. They liken it to gambling.
It was hard work, though.
It was very hard work. It was very hard work, but you didn't intend to keep doing it for very long.
And if you failed, in many instances, you didn't want to come home with failure trailing behind you.
You didn't, but that means you headed off someplace else. You didn't stick around here, too. So, I mean, one of the things we forget about these booms is that there's an incredible churning of population. As you see the numbers, but those 10,000 people, each year it's a different 10,000. They're in, they're out, they're gone. And that's one of the characteristics of boom towns then and I think now, too.
Well, let's talk about now with Leslie Berlin, who, again, is project historian for the Silicon Valley Archives at Stanford University and author of The Man Behind the Microchip, Robert Noyce, and The Invention of Silicon Valley. The invention of Silicon Valley, contrary to many people's perception, wasn't necessarily so much in garages, as I think you point out in an article of yours I read. It was largely financial and technological and cultural.
And I would be quick to add, very heavily dependent on the Department of Defense and military spending, particularly early on. As a matter of fact, I think it's safe to sort of point the birth of Silicon Valley to World War II, when you have, two major influences. One is the actual location of Silicon Valley, which is for all the shipbuilding and such that was happening up in the city, people who were starting to think about starting companies thought, we want to go somewhere where there's not such a strong union presence. And that was actually a significant factor in addition to the incredibly cheap cost of land in what is now Silicon Valley during the World War II era.
Ah, to remember.
Yes. So But in addition, this sorts of military spending that we're talking about was absolutely vital. If you look at the early Silicon Valley companies, if you take, for example, just Hewlett-Packard and look at their profits, it's a nice little up and to the right line until World War II, when you have this absolute hockey stick. And the 100%, if you jump forward about 15 years, 100% of the microchips that were built and invented here in Silicon Valley were bought by the Department of Defense for use in Cold War technology. So from the very beginning, this economy in Silicon Valley was very dependent on the military. In fact, I would go so far as to say that the military served as the first venture capitalist in Silicon Valley.
Well, I noticed also that you point out that Shockley and particularly the transistor were sort of major in terms of helping to shape what became Silicon Valley.
Yeah. I'm always a little afraid of sounding too deterministic, but I think that the reality of the technology that was planted here, namely the transistor, which arrived in 1956 in the form of William Shockley, who would go on to win the Nobel Prize for his invention of the transistor, you could not have picked a more wonderful technology to lay in the very fertile ground, and I mean that both literally and metaphorically, that was Silicon Valley. Because you can think of the transistor as as the grain of sand inside of a pearl that still continues to grow. So
From there to microchips, on and on we go,
right.
Morphing. Yeah,
exactly, until you get to personal computers and then all the cloud technology. Everything that we think of as high tech today can, if you peel it away far enough, go back to that transistor. And a lot of the business and cultural sorts of how-to lessons that people learned in figuring out how to build and market the transistor, and especially the microchip, the integrated circuit, and going forward from that, have come into play in future generations of the technology, of the economy.
And yet, when we look at the two most recent booms in Silicon Valley, I was kidding with Holly before about the computer superhighway, almost seems nostalgic to think about that, but there really are fewer beneficiaries now. I mean, the last one, people joke about, you know, petfood.com and all the rest of those kinds of things, but now there's much more money going up to the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this gets back to what we were talking about earlier about who gets the jobs. For well into the 80s, you had actual manufacturing jobs in Silicon Valley that were very high-paying jobs, not unionized, but high-paying because people there was so much competition that people could market themselves into good jobs just about anywhere. Now there's very little manufacturing in Silicon Valley. And what that means is that the primary beneficiaries are the highly educated, almost all in the science, technology, engineering, math fields.
Could we just do a little comparison about the two again, what's often called Silicon Valley 2 as opposed to Silicon Valley 1 or dot-com 1 versus whatever followed it. There's much more upfront costs that really took place. I mean, now not so much is needed in the second boom. And now it's more actually in some instances young people, you know, thinking up their apps and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And another big difference that I'll be interested to see how this plays out is, of course, part of the problem with the first dot-com boom was that these companies were they were in the public markets and growing like crazy. This meant a lot more of the general public who invests in these sorts of things was exposed. Right now, a lot of these companies are still private companies. When you look at who is actually building these things and starting these companies, right now people are able to become quite wealthy on small things like apps that you're describing. And whereas in the past, these dot-com type companies, these were large. There were lots of people involved from very early on, whereas now it's much smaller groups of people getting going.
Why do you think it stayed in Silicon Valley? I mean, when one became two, it was still Silicon Valley. It wasn't Detroit. It wasn't Cleveland. It wasn't Dallas or any place else.
This, to me, is the most interesting question about Silicon Valley that I'm never asked, which is why is it that it has persisted from the 1950s forward? Because this place has been able to bring in technology after technology after technology. I think that what happened was that you essentially had a self-perpetuating cycle kick off in as early as I would say the 60s and 70s. We developed an entire infrastructure around supporting entrepreneurs. And that has continued to exist to this day in terms of venture capital investment, angel investment. There's a very, very strong sense here among established and successful entrepreneurial types that they have a responsibility to go back and bring up the next generation of entrepreneurs. I think that has had a lot to do with it. And I also think that this sort of path dependency is, I think, really undervalued when people think about different regions. I think that everyone imagines the internet making it possible for us to transcend geography. You don't have to live where you work and this sort of thing. But I think that the sort of being in a place where you're constantly crossing other people who are doing what you're doing and interested in what you're in, not just at work, but at a little league game or when you're walking the dog or you're at church or you're at the grocery store or you're wherever you may be, these sorts of interactions lead to a general sense of, I can only describe it as cultural excitement that hasn't really been replicable anywhere else, including online.
And let's not minimize just how nice it is to live in the Bay Area. I mean, there are many venture capitalists who would agree very quickly with that, as well as others who make up Silicon Valley. But let's talk about immigration, because Richard White played a central role really in all these booms.
Yeah, it's starting with the gold rush. I mean, the gold rush is, as I said, California has 40% to 50% immigrants in by 1860. And I think, I mean, Chris can correct me here, but I think up until the 20th century, California is by far the heaviest immigrant state, large state in the country. We always retain that, and San Francisco always retained it. It's Chinese, it's German, it's Irish. World War II, it's less immigrants from abroad, of course, but it's immigrants from all over the country are coming in, particularly
immigrants. You mentioned Isabel Wilkerson's book about the migration from the Black South.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the Black South and the White South, too. I mean, it's Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas. They move in. And then, of course, the current boom is a boom which once were more California's multi-ethnic, multinational. So in these ways, all the booms do string together. They've all been heavily influenced by immigrants from outside.
There's new brain power that comes with immigrants, of course, but Christopher O'Sullivan, there's also the darker side of that. I mean, there were laws that were put in place against Mexicans during the gold rush. There were certainly laws against the Chinese that came later, although they were able to stay, and there was all that was done to the Indians.
Yeah. The Chinese faced a miner's tax in the 1850s, which was not applicable to other groups. There was terrible rampant racism throughout San Francisco in the 1850s. Roving gangs. Richard was talking about the lawlessness in this sort of a libertarian dream of a city of San Francisco where there were no laws. There were vigilance committees taking over and trying to establish some semblance of laws, but often carrying out horrible miscarriages of justice. And we've seen that. You know, Richard talked about immigrants coming into California, even within the country, we see a big surge of racism during the Second World War because suddenly California has a very, very small population of African Americans before the war. President Roosevelt signs an executive order in the summer of 1941, 6 months before Pearl Harbor, saying that there cannot be racial discrimination in wartime industries. And there's an enormous migration of both white and black people from all over the country, but particularly from the South and Texas and the Southwest to these industries in California, these wartime industries, shipping, aerospace, things like this. And the population, the African-American population of California surges to about 13%. Interesting, if you look at San Francisco, that was roughly the African-American population at this peak after the war, and it's now down to about 6%. So something very curious has happened to the African-American population in San Francisco, having dropped by more than half since its peak level.
And in Silicon Valley, of course, we had a lot of Asians who have come in and many people from particularly South Asia, India and so forth who continue to work there. Leslie Berlin. And there's also been the charge that this culture, we're talking about really cultures that grow up with the boom and become inseparable from the boom, has been, so it's argued, misogynistic. There have been glass ceilings where women are concerned. It's kind of a good old boys fraternity club and so forth. How much do you feel that really plays into outcome of the culture itself?
Yeah, this is something that I haven't studied myself, but the reports of discrimination against women have been very compelling and very upsetting. I think a lot of this is a sort of unconscious bias that's happening, and some of it is just outright misogyny. I can speak to that just from the perspective of someone who's read the same materials, listened to you, and listened to other people talking about it. And in terms of the role of immigrants, this is the one thing that I wish that people could take away about Silicon Valley. I mean, in Santa Clara County, 65% of the people with bachelor's degrees in Silicon Valley were born in another country. I mean, this is amazing. Two-thirds of the people who have completed college who live in Santa Clara County, which for a long time was sort of considered Silicon Valley. That definition has expanded, which we can talk about. Two-thirds of them are from born outside the country. Half of the companies started between 1995 and 2005. Half of them have at least one founder who was born outside of the United States. And I have to believe that number is higher now. I think that this constant sort of refresh, this sort of intellectual refresh that comes with new waves of immigrants just can't be underestimated. And it's the reason that we see so much lobbying from tech companies about extending H-1B visas and keeping the doors open because the economy with all of its very real problems will only remain as vibrant as it is if this continues to be a highly desirable place to live. And I think this is part of the reason why we've seen people who are up in arms on all sides of the wage gap sorts of questions, because everyone wants this to be a place where people want to come and want to stay.
How about people of color, though, particularly at the top of Silicon Valley in the upper hierarchy? It's still a tough place to find oneself if one has a different color skin, is it not?
Well, I think that a lot of these companies actually do have founders who are from Asia, and I don't think that it's a particularly uncomfortable place in that sense. There are a lot of organizations that exist, things like TAI, the Indus Entrepreneurs. A lot of the universities, actually, from, say, South Korea, they have alumni organizations here that are incredibly strong, vibrant types of organizations that provide a lot of support. So I think that there is recognition that it is a very different kind of place. At the same time, I do think that a high-tech company is not a terrible place to be if you are someone who has the education behind you. Then your skin color, I think, is less important. Now, the question of who gets the education, that's another question.
That's another question indeed. And I wanted to go back to Christopher O'Sullivan and just ask you, if I may, about gentrification. These booms push people out.
Yes.
Certainly what we see now in Silicon Valley, and there's natural fallout with the boom. Is there anything different about this boom in that regard that you see?
Well, very much so. I mean, if you look back, if we talk again about the Second World War and the Cold War, for example, a lot of the job creation that occurred as a result of that federal spending here was, well, I guess, what we'd call blue-collar work, and a lot of it was unionized. San Francisco was always a strong industrial union city, a very strong presence of the American Federation of Labor, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and the current job growth is not really in that area. So we're finding that it's much more white-collar. As you mentioned, it requires a certain skill level, a certain skill set, higher education. So we have really, in a sense, abandoned a large swath of the population of the Bay Area who not only benefited from that job creation during the war and the Cold War, but keep in mind a big difference is that we had visionary governors at that time, Earl Warren, Goodwin Knight, Pat Brown, who thought about sustaining the boom. And how do you sustain the boom if you're anticipating the possibility of a bust? Investment in education. This is at least one way that you can try to mitigate some of the valleys, some of the troughs of a disastrous bust.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum from our archives. Our guests were KQED Executive News Editor Holly Kernan, Leslie Berlin from Stanford Silicon Valley Archives, Christopher O'Sullivan from the University of San Francisco, and Professor Richard White from Stanford University. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Our interns are Maxine Schofer-Wolf and Brandon Yu. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum up ahead on this Labor Day.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.